From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, Michael Keaton talks about his Oscar-nominated performance in the film Birdman. In one of the scenes, he's standing on the edge of a 9-story building. While filming it, he had a cable attached to him for protection, but he couldn't help thinking about the movie's relatively low budget.
To be honest with you, you go, yeah, you know, I'd probably feel better if the movie were, you know, like $90 million and I'm cabled in than you know, a few million dollars, because you go, who did they get exactly to secure me to this building, you know?
Michael Keaton also tells us about his other films and his life. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by singer Tiffany Austin. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company dedicated to helping clients achieve lifelong financial well-being. A global asset manager with award-winning performance, TIAA CREF was founded nearly a century ago to serve those who serve others in the academic, medical, cultural, governmental, and research fields. Its investment model and long-term approach are aimed at delivering outcomes that benefit clients. TIAA CREF, created to serve and built to perform. At TIAA.org.
Today, we're concluding our week showcasing some of our favorite interviews of the year to date by revisiting Terry's interview with actor Michael Keaton.
How did we end up here in this dump? You were a movie star, remember?
Michael Keaton was nominated for an Oscar for his starring performance in the film Birdman, which is now out on DVD. He didn't win, but the film did walk away with 4 Oscars: Best Picture, Director, Cinematography, and Original Screenplay. Birdman is an existential comedy, with Keaton playing an actor named Regan Thompson, who's having a creative and personal identity crisis. He'd been famous for starring as the superhero Birdman in 3 films. But he gave up the franchise years ago and has been struggling to figure out who he is as an actor and a man. He's dealing with the actor crisis by trying to prove his artistic worth, directing and starring on Broadway in his own adaptation of a Raymond Carver story. During rehearsals and previews, he constantly second-guesses himself. His insecurities and doubts, as well as his self-absorption, are physically manifested in the form of Birdman, who keeps appearing to Regan, badgering him about having given up a lucrative Hollywood career for a play in an old Broadway theater. In this scene, Regan has just come off stage after one of several previews that turned into fiascos. He walks into his shabby dressing room, opens the little refrigerator, takes a slice of packaged cold cuts, and talks with his daughter, Sam, who is working as his assistant. Sam is played by Emma Stone.
Dad. Dad.
Hey.
Are you okay?
Why?
You seem sort of...
No, I'm good. I'm good. This is good. You want some?
No.
Okay.
Do you really think you'll be ready for opening tomorrow?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, previews are pretty much a train wreck. We can't seem to get through a performance without a raging fire or a raging heart on. I'm broke. I'm not sleeping, like, you know, at all. And this play kind of starting to feel like a miniature, deformed version of myself that just keeps following me around and, like, hitting me in the balls with a tiny little hammer. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Never mind.
Michael Keaton, welcome to Fresh Air. I love Birdman and I love your performance in it. When I saw the movie, I thought, perfect. Michael Keaton has done two Batman films and was famous for that. He must really relate to this character who used to be a superhero and had been famous for that. And then I read or heard you say that you'd never played a character more unlike yourself before. So explain why, even though I thought you'd be resonating so much with the character, you kind of didn't, in spite of your great performance.
Well, you know, I probably should qualify that a little more than when I said it, which was a long time ago. I don't connect to that type of personality. I tend to not have those kind of personality traits, that constant neediness and insecurity and whininess and, you know, me, 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 the narcissism. You know, when you're one of originally nine children, you know, there's not a ton of room for that. And, you know, I was raised Catholic, so speaking about yourself or talking about yourself too much is not necessarily – and, you know, then on the Protestant side of my family, even more so, do you not talk about yourself. So the whole thing of being self-involved took me a long, long time where I thought it was okay to talk about myself. But so it doesn't come to me naturally.
Birdman is in part about acting, about the egos, about all the talk about being truthful on stage. The actor that Edward Norton plays is like 100% authentic on stage, but as his girlfriend points out, he's a fraud in the real world where it counts. And with you, every time something awful or ridiculous happens to your character, like being locked out of the theater in your underwear, it seems to just bring out a deeper, more honest, and more emotional performance in the play that your character is performing in within the movie. And you get more and more naked metaphorically and literally as the movie progresses. So the movie's kind of operating on two levels. It's kind of mocking actors, but also getting to what makes their work so beautiful and so deeply felt. What did you do to get to the truth of your character, who you've told us is in a lot of ways not like you?
Well, boy, that's about it. Just listening to what you just said is about as well put as I've heard it through all these interviews.
You.
That's about it. And it's true. And you know, listening to you describe it, it really resonates again with me, thinking about what Alejandro accomplished in Chivo, Emmanuel Lubezki, the cinematographer and the camera operator and the crew and the cast and what everybody and the producers, what everyone really pulled off here in 29 days for very little money. And then I kind of retroactively become extremely frightened thinking, what was I thinking? why did I ever think I should do this? And I think maybe really if I would have thought about it too much, it would have been overwhelming, because I actually end up playing kind of four different characters in the movie, which really didn't occur to me till we were about a week and a half or 2 weeks in, thank God. If you factor in that I play characters in the play and then an actor who is actually directing other actors, and then I play those actors, and then I play the Birdman character, the actual Birdman, and my alter ego. And day to day and doing the work and getting to that honest point, that's, for me, it's always about, and it always will be as long as I do this, refining and refining and refining and refining the truth. Just telling the truth constantly, being as truthful and honest and raw and real as you can be. And, you know, sometimes you fail. But to go down, you know, to be frightened and to go down that hole and to be as raw as you can be, that's a blessing to me to get that opportunity. You know, I could have failed miserably. People could have laughed at me and, you know, made fun of me for the rest of my life. And honestly, it probably would have hurt my feelings a lot. And then I would have gotten by it and said, well, you know what? Doesn't really matter because I got a big set of balls. So.
One of the really special things about the film is how it's shot and choreographed. There's a scene, and it's the scene that we opened the show with, in which you're taking some food out of the refrigerator after coming off a performance in which you'd locked yourself out of the theater and had to walk in your underwear around to the main entrance of the theater in order to get in, then walk down the aisle, do your performance on stage, finish the performance, and then go backstage and have that talk with your daughter. Is that all one take?
No, that
but,
is not
but
all
not one,
one
take.
But
I mean like one shot.
That's all one. Yes, I know what you mean. It's no, that is not all one shot,
okay.
But it's only two, like I would say like two and a half, really, because and you know, you're right. Actually, when I was listening to you explain to the audience how it was shot, even now I keep remembering things and I think about all the details, because not only was it all those things you said, going down the hallway, another actor has to enter precisely at a moment, then there might be three people in the hallway, then you go downstairs. It was even things like downstairs, out a doorway into the hallway where I see Edward, then we walk down the sidewalk. It had to be timed perfectly to get to a line exactly when I tossed the coins to the drummer, and then timed out so we were dead on the exact word, not just the line, to enter the bar, and then went into the bar and did the scene, and then that whole scene runs through the bar, and then I go over and I walk back out. Well, the scene you're talking about, I think, was almost that long. So in all those shots, often it was also a cab had to pull up at the right time.
Right.
You know, and all the little details, and he is so detail-oriented. I mean, I can't imagine what it meant in his mind, in his brain, Alejandro's and Chivo's. But also, the actors had to be aware of it. I had to be aware of it. I had to know kind of what was going to happen at all time, and at the same time, stay right in the moment and stay locked in the character and be cognizant of all of every tiny detail that was happening in every tiny little bit of the frame. At the same time, forget it and just be in the moment and be truthful and just be the character, you know. Man, there's a lot to this movie.
So let me mention that scene again where you get locked out of the theater.
Yeah.
You leave your dressing room and, to have a smoke and accidentally got locked out, and you're in your underwear. It's raining out. So you have to walk around Times Square and get back into the theater through the main entrance where the ushers don't even recognize you and don't want to let you in. But anyways, right. while your character is walking around Times Square, he's recognized because he used to be, you know, the superhero Birdman. People are taking his picture right. and posting it on Twitter and YouTube. And so you really did walk across Times Square in your underwear to shoot that scene. Was it all extras who were watching you, or were there real people there too?
Real people, because you couldn't once again, though, I'm sorry, just give me a second here. Every time I hear you just describe things really well, I start to remember things again or realize things that I'm not sure I realized at the time, because as he described other things, I thought, you know, it was not just the scene, the entire movie. It was, for Regan Thompson, one indignity after another.
You know, and his fly is open half the time, too.
Yes, just horrible. Just yeah. getting worse and worse and worse. Now, what's fortunate about all that is I happen to find that stuff really, really funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a weird job. The fact that I think that's a good idea to do that on a large screen and let millions of people watch it, and I think that's a good idea. That's really weird to choose that as an occupation. But I really do think that stuff is really, really funny.
Did you buy special underwear for the scene? It looks like just your regular...
Yeah, I wanted to go.
Regular
and what,
shorts.
You know, and,
yeah.
and immediately
briefs,
as soon
briefs,
as...
Briefs, briefs, not shorts.
Briefs,
yeah.
Yes, what they call briefs. And I knew I wanted to look... They're pathetic enough, but what really is the beautiful finishing touch is the black socks. That's what really sold me. Just so sad and pathetic, and him trying to hold his dignity up somehow, you know.
When you're walking through the crowd, it's like you're power walking, like your arms are kind of pumping back and forth, almost as if like you're literally swimming through the crowd and you need your arms to propel you.
Yes. Here's a practical part of that. I'm a runner, you know, so in a jogger and a hiker and a walker, et cetera. So my wind's pretty good, my legs are pretty strong, and I can move. I can still go, you know, for a guy, you know, my age, I can, but you can't really, because camera can only go so fast. So you start to invent things. And one of the things I thought was just hold yourself upright kind of and do a strut that'll work for camera, but also look like kind of stupid, not stupid, but yeah. kind of, you know, kind of like not silly, because you can't go silly, but in a way, like kind of hold up his dignity. But in that shot, everyone talks about that stretch. For me, the front part of that, when I get caught in the door and how I was going to play the reality of how do I get out of this jam? And when Regan walks away and try to like, because into this crouch, like maybe if I crouch, no one will notice I'm in the underwear.
Your character played a superhero called Birdman, and the Birdman character follows him around as his alter ego, and he's always just kind of insulting him and hectoring him and saying, like, why did you, you know, you should have taken the role. You should have, like, played Birdman again, and you should have taken that reality show that you were offered instead of, like, doing this theater stuff. And so
yeah.
So his alter ego is basically insulting him a good deal of the time. That's your voice, the voice of the Birdman alter ego, right? Mm,
right, right.
And are you also in the costume? Or is that somebody else?
No, that's me. And by the way, same dimensions as the original Batman suit, I'm very proud to say.
You haven't put on any weight.
Well, I did actually early on in this movie. And Alejandro would go to lunch with me and look at the plate, look at the waiter, look at me and stand there and go, keep pushing the plate. Because, you know, the guy's down and out and been, you know, he's out of shape, et cetera, et cetera. So he really wanted that. But anyway, yes, it is me. And also, you know, Alejandro really and I worked on this early on, rehearsing, talking about it. Then we went into rehearsals, then we shot it. And then the post, in terms of getting the voice and getting the character and rewriting all that dialogue or monologue or language, you know, that Birdman comes up with and rewriting it and going back and trying different recording. Like, he wanted to do it really in a great studio, and then he didn't like the sound of it. It sounded too kind of perfect, so we found a place where the sound wasn't nearly as good, and we even had one where we could hear noise coming in from the window outside. And he's relentless and perfectionistic, and I was, you know, we had wrapped the movie, and he and I continued to work on it and work on it and work on it.
Let's hear a moment of you as the Birdman, and this is his voice kind of like taunting you.
How did we end up here in this dump? You were a movie star, remember?
Okay, there he is, like, insulting you because you're doing theater instead of a superhero movie. So is that a processed version of your voice?
No. How that happened was when I did Batman, the first one, because I'm ridiculously logical, I got to have some reason for truth in the matter. Even if I am playing a guy in a big black rubber suit, I got to believe somewhere, you know, how I got to justify certain things. So, you know, we were doing a scene with Tim, and I said, hey, you know, we're downtown Gotham. I'm, you know, like 4.5 feet from one of the dignitaries in town. And I was looking at the lighting, and I said, this is not believable. You know, the guy's going to say, he's going to hear my voice. He's going to see my mouth and, you know, whatever he can see and go, hey, it's Bruce Wayne, everybody. You know, so I thought, I got to get around this. We got to, like, change my angle, or we got to – and Tim thought it was a great idea, so we lit it kind of differently. And I said – I had already thought of creating a very subtle change in his personality when he went from Bruce Wayne to Batman anyway. I kind of did it. A lot of it was cut out, but I did these other things. But just to justify it for me, I said, I got to make at least some voice change, something here that I can at least believe. You know, so I kind of did the shift in the voice at the top of the movie where I kicked the guy into the door when he asked me who I am or what I am or whatever he asked me. And then I continued to use that voice when I was in the Batman thing, just, you know, as a thing. So I was telling the story to Alejandro, and he thought it was tremendous and funny, and he calls Chivo, Emmanuel Lubezki, over, goes, Chivo, listen to this. So we started laughing, and he said, oh, my God, you have to do that. That's it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do a voice for Birdman. So I said, okay. And then the voice changed and changed and changed. It got a little more gravelly, and he got more. And he wanted me to go deeper with the voice, and then raspy voice, then more dramatic. Then he'd hear it and would go back like a week later and change it again. But that's really – that was the origin of it, and it became some kind of bastardized version of what the original Batman voice was.
So, you know, you're talking about the voice that you use as Birdman in the film Birdman and comparing that to the voice you used as Batman in your Batman film. So let's hear a short scene from the first Batman in 1989, directed, as you said, by Tim Burton. And this is from early in the movie, and two criminals are on a rooftop. They've just robbed a place. They're looking at their loot. And then you appear as Batman. You fight them off. You repel their bullets with your body armor. You use your Batman grappling hook. And then you dangle one of the muggers off the side of the building, and he's hollering for you to spare him.
Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man. Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man.
I'm not going to kill you. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
Yeah!
And as we can hear, Batman has a very stirring theme. And in Birdman, and in Birdman, your character is always imagining that when he's fantasizing the powers that he had as Birdman and wanting those powers, he's fantasizing like his theme music behind him.
Yes, right, which is majestic and symphonic and really, like when he's flying. You mean, yeah, and beautiful actually. It's funny. I was just listening to that score, which is a great score. It's great. And when you hear it, it's not that it sounds dated. Because it's really good, actually. But you think, oh, I forgot it was that kind of score, you know, Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
And how about the courage when Alejandro said, I said, hey, you know, because I really liked his score in Babel, and I wanted to know what that instrument was. It sounded like a mandolin. It's actually not. I think it's a Middle Eastern stringed instrument. He told me what it was. That kind of is the base for that. And we were talking about that, and I said, what are you thinking about? You're going to use those guys again? And he said, no, I think I'm going to do drums, only drums. And I go, really? And he goes, yeah. And I'm thinking, yeah, good luck. He's never going to stick to that. This movie's going to need manipulation. It's going to need strings and, you know, blah, 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 because it's already risky what he's trying. Man, when I saw it, and he stuck to it and stuck with just the, I thought, wow. Man, this guy's got some guts.
Getting back to Batman, how did it feel to be wearing the cape and the tights?
Simultaneously ridiculous to the point where you had to overcome it, and risky, and I guess kind of cool. I'm claustrophobic, so I had to work through that. It ended up working really perfectly for the character. It made me feel real isolated inside there. Couldn't really hear. So that really ended up being a bonus, a plus for me. But once again, you think, oh boy, this is one of those things. This could really go down. This could just be a huge mistake. But if you punk out, or if you go halfway, or if you don't commit to it, or if you get frightened and kind of want to save yourself and not look, you know, that just doesn't work. That's just never going to work. So, not to me anyway. So you commit to it and say, okay, you know, I'm in. Let's make this thing work. And plus, I had the advantage also that the imagery is so strong and powerful. And once I saw that, I went, oh, this, I'm going to work this thing, man. I'm going to work the angles of the suit, the shadows of the suit, the frighteningness of it, the sexiness of it. I'm going to work the hell out of that.
So Tim Burton first cast you in Beetlejuice in 1988, and the story revolves around a couple played by Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin who are killed in a car accident, and they return to their home as ghosts, and a new family moves in, and Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis want these people out. So they go to another ghost played by you, Beetlejuice, who is a bio-exorcist. And it's his job to, like, scare these people out of the house. Let's play a scene. And this is the first scene where you meet the couple played by Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis.
You know what's really beautiful about this? You two kids picked me. You didn't have to, but you picked me. It makes me want to kiss you guys. Come on. Come on.
No.
Give me one.
No.
You're Harlan, huh? All right. Let's get down to business. You're right. I got a card around here somewhere. Here. Who do I have to kill? Here, hold that for me, would you?
Whoa! Ow!
There you go.
You don't have to kill anybody.
Ah, possession. Good. Learn to throw your voice. Fool your friends. Fun at parties.
No, we just want to get some people out of our house.
Ah, I understand. Well, look, in order to do that, I'm really going to have to get to know you guys. You know, we got to get closer. Move in with you for a while. Get to be real pals. You know what I'm saying? Save that guy for later. Huh?
My wife and I would like to ask you a couple of questions.
Sure. Go ahead, shoot.
Well, for instance, what are your qualifications?
Ah, well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it. Not to mention the fact that you're talking to a dead guy. Now, what do you think? You think I'm qualified?
That's hysterical. You are so manic in that. And your voice reminds me a little bit of the voice we were talking about for Birdman.
Yeah, I guess.
Did it hurt to do that voice?
You know, I'm not in the movie that much, frankly. You know, listen to that. Man, that brings back. I actually, you laid out the the storyline of Beetlejuice, and I went, oh, that's right. That's what that's about. I forgot what the movie was about. and I realized how much of that was just written on the spot. I would just riff, you know, I would just riff.
Oh, really?
And run. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. That wasn't the majority of that. That whole speech, in fact, was not really, you know, the whole, well, I attended Juilliard. And that was none of that was on the script, on the page. A lot of Beetlejuice was not on the page. The basics were kind of there. And I said, well, if I'm going to play him, I'm going to play him like this. And what do you think? And they were great. You know, Tim was tremendous about, you know, he was open to my interpretation.
So did you grow up in a farmhouse in Western Pennsylvania?
Yeah, actually, it was an old farmhouse. The first house we grew up in we grew up, really, we were kind of country people mostly, but, well, in Pittsburgh anyway, Western Pennsylvania, there were mill towns or railroad towns, you know, and most of them were mill towns. My mom came from a mill town, a steel mill town down on the river. But in between was very rural. And then, you know, I wasn't that far from West Virginia, really, the border between Pennsylvania and West Virginia. And so when the very, very first house we were in, I'm looking at the studio. Honestly, I'm not exaggerating this. It was about, man, I don't know, three of these studios big with a little attic bedroom upstairs where my mother and father slept, and I slept in a crib in that room. And there must have been a period where my sister slept up there too, because there were, at that point, there was a period where there were seven kids in a very small house. Very nice, neat, clean little house, but a small house. Then we moved right down the road because my father got the family farmhouse, which was totally run down. And I loved that house. It was huge and just fun and pockets and places to play and an old porch that barely was standing, you know, that you could jump off of into the, you know, there were no steps. It was just this old
electricity, plumbing. Did you have that?
Well, we didn't. Yeah, we had electricity. And I, you know, I never saw it as later, about a year ago, my sister told me, she said, you know, when we moved to that house, we didn't have plumbing. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, we didn't have it. We didn't have an indoor bathroom. She said, you know, it took a while for Dad to fix things up, and he had to do it himself, you know, kind of fix the pipes and hook it up and do everything. And then by the time, you know, he was always working two jobs, you know, his own surveying job, and he was kind of working on and off for the county. And then I didn't know that. And so I guess and I was really still small. And then finally we got indoor plumbing. It sounds silly. It's not like we lived for years like that, you know. And then we moved down the road, and that house burnt down, actually, our old farmhouse, which was a sad day for me.
After you moved, it burned down?
Yeah, we had moved down, and one day it just caught fire and just burned to the ground. And I'll never forget that night. We heard there was a fire. We all went up in our little pajamas and watched our old house burn down. It really made me feel sad. I love that house. I think my mom and dad were glad to see it go. It was really hard to maintain. It was old, and, you know, my mom kept it really clean, and she did her best, but...
So your mother had seven children.
My mom had nine children.
She lost two of them?
And she lost two babies, yeah.
So you were the youngest of the seven kids who survived.
Yeah, yeah.
What did it mean to be the youngest?
It was kind of great. Building an audience, you know. A lot of love, people. People kissing you and playing with you and beating you up all the time, you know, wrestling with you. And you always had to, like, you know, there was always wrestling. You had four guys in the family, so somebody's always, like, hitting somebody or chasing somebody or getting mad or fighting or wrestling or, you know, it was just, like, what you did. And so when you're the youngest, you know, it's good for you. You figure out real early how to get out of headlocks and holds really quickly, how to squirm your way out of your older brothers and sisters fighting. We're all really close, you know, we're all very, very close.
Was TV in your life from the very beginning? Did your family own a TV?
Yeah. That's how I knew. That's how I figured all this out or fell in love with it. You know, books, reading, and stories that I would read, stories that I would make up. But television, you know, little television set. There was a period when I was really young where we had the only television I don't know if it was miles around, but my mother and father talk about people, neighbors coming down to watch something on the television, you know. And, you know, then people started getting television sets. We had a black and white TV, and I would watch old, you know, occasionally old movies would play on that. And then some television shows. I loved the Westerns, and I loved real Westerns. I loved gangster movies, you know, or army movies, you know. I was a ridiculously cliched kid, you know, anything that was male, boy, fighting, shooting, you know, all that stuff. I was just in love with it. I also loved gangster movies, Jimmy Cagney and John Garfield and all that stuff, you know. And then the comedies, I really got into the comedies.
So your parents were Catholic and observant.
My mom was. My dad was a Protestant. And, you know, that was
oh,
a big
that's right.
deal.
You're right. Right. So what did that make you?
It was a blessing because I distinctly remember, you know, hearing only Catholics are going to heaven. And I was blessed by it because I bought the whole deal in Catholic school. I was a good Catholic kid, altar boy and all that. And I remember thinking, well, now, wait a minute. My dad's not Catholic. I haven't really seen him do anything really that wrong. You know what I'm going? This doesn't hold up logically to me. So I think somewhere in the back of my head, I tucked it away. I went, I'm kind of in. I'm mostly in on the religion thing, but not totally. That was a blessing in disguise, I think. You know, it really made me open-minded to things, I think.
Did you have an official exit point?
No, because I loved being raised Catholic. I think I really like it. And I still, you know, if I meditate, I still occasionally find that because that's familiar territory. I'll find a church I think is cool, but not often. Or, you know, there were exit points kind of early on, you know, like in, you know, I was kind of a kid who got in trouble in high school and I was a party boy in college and I was a lot of fun. And also, you know, you start reading more and learning more and you're open to more people, you know, and different viewpoints. And, you know, I'm a curious dude, so I read a lot. But I never was one of those guys who went, oh, my God, this is scarring. This is horrible. You know, I thought it was pretty cool. I liked it. And I love Pope Francis. I think he's pretty cool. I hope the other slipper doesn't fall, as they say. You know, we don't find out something weird down the road. I hope he gets in and out and everybody goes, wow, how about that dude? You know.
So your family name, the family that you're from, the family name is Douglas. But
yeah.
Because Michael Douglas was already Michael Douglas when you started acting professionally, you changed your name to Michael Keaton. Did you resent at all that somebody kind of owned your name already in the public
yes.
sphere?
Yes, I didn't think about it then, but I didn't resent it. I just thought, I actually like my name. You know, I've always kind of it's my name. I'm pretty good with it. And I use it actually occasionally. I use it in private life all the time. It's my name. That's who I am. You know, but I just use the other one for jobs, which makes it really easy, clear. Frankly, makes things very simple. You know, this is how I make my career, this is how I make a living, and this is how I live my life. And I sneak it in, I directed a little movie, and I'm going to use it. I like my name. I want to tuck it in there somewhere. I'm trying not to go through the whole John Cougar Mellencamp thing, which went on for years.
So you changed it to Keaton in honor of Buster
Keaton?
Yeah,
no, just randomly. Trust me, I'll talk about it if you want to talk about it. It's so dull, I can't tell you. I mean, really, I've been through this literally thousands of times, or at least hundreds of times. But if you want to hear it, I'll tell you. But honestly, you'll nap. If you haven't had a nap, now would be a good time. There's a union. You can't get in. If somebody's got a name, I got a gig. I didn't make up a name. I was in the K's. I said, this seems kind of down the middle of the road, kind of flows nicely, and I'll figure out a cool name, you know, in a few weeks when I get the next job. And they said, you got to sign this thing now. You're going to start work tomorrow. Made it up, never changed it, and that's it.
All right.
Good
oh,
for
I'm
you.
Sorry.
Wise choice.
So can I play you just like one little clip from Birdman? I want to know who this voice is because it sounds so familiar and I can't place it. It's a great voice. There's a scene in Birdman, and this isn't a spoiler because it's in the trailer, when you're on the roof and you're kind of feeling your Birdman's superpower, but you're also in a very vulnerable state and people are looking at you on the roof and not knowing, is this guy a jumper or is this a movie? Like, what is going on? So here's a woman who's yelling up at you.
A film!
You people are full of crap.
I love that. Who is that voice?
That makes me laugh. That's her. As far as I know, that's that actress. You see, the thing about this movie is you look at even that, you barely see that woman, and she just nailed that. Every little role was performed really well by really good actors in this movie. I really love that scene. That makes me laugh a lot when she says that. That's that actress.
Like what actress? Like you don't know
I
her
can't
name.
Remember a woman's
right,
name,
okay,
no. Because
okay.
I actually never met her, actually, because
that was just added in?
No, she performed, and she was right on cue. I mean, I kept thinking, oh, man, you know, I'm standing on the edge of this building, you know, and this is nervous me. I'm not crazy about heights. And 9 stories up, and I'm thinking, man, I hope everybody's on their cue. And they were, and she was right on it. Because it had to happen at a precise moment when the camera comes up the side of the building and it's like inches from my face and then swirls around the back and has to pick her up. And so she had to be cued precisely. That's just something that people don't get. They don't realize how hard all that stuff is to do, you know. And it's not like you have $80 million or $120 million in days to – in different crews, you know, like 4 crews where this was handmade. And, you know, we had to pull all that stuff off.
So when you're on the edge of that roof, 9 stories high, and you have
knees shaking,
and you have fear of heights, do you have any protection?
Yeah, you know, you're cabled in, and the guys were great and all that.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, to be honest with you, you go, yeah, you know, I'd probably feel better if the movie were, you know, like $90 million and I'm cabled in than you know, a few million dollars, because you go, who did they get exactly to secure me to this building, you know? This is a guy who works like once every 9 years and goes, yeah, I got a garage, but I'll, you know, down the road, but I got some cables, I'll do it for you, you know? That was my fear more than the – and standing on the edge of 9 stories is not pleasant. And also you need to, you know, I thought more than anything, I really want to be locked into the guy here. He's really fragile. And once again, it worked. You know, the fear, I think I just thought, and I picked a spot deep, far in the horizon to focus on, to set, so I wouldn't, because I didn't want to teeter and go in and out of focus when the camera came up, so we'd get the shot. But also, you know, remember lines had to be on cue and be convincing, but then say, but, you know, what's my state right now? So I focused across the way, never realizing as the camera come up inches from my face, your depth of field changes and you get disoriented. And the remarkable job of the focus puller, I mean, just this guy just nailed it. Some of those things could be 20 takes, and we nailed it the first time, really, and then we just did 2 more just to have it.
Well, what you're describing is perfect, because your character at that point is kind of wobbling between this superhero image that he still has and being at the most vulnerable point of his life.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just – that's right. He's really now entering that really, really dark – he's gone. He's kind of – I think this is the beginning of him being liberated, you know. This is the beginning.
Yes.
Where he just says, you know, hell with it, man.
You say – use the word liberated, and mm-hmm. – everyone I know who's seen the movie has the discussion about what does the ending mean. Do you want to say anything about what it means to you, or would you prefer not?
I can say what Alejandro says, which I really agree with, which is it has as many interpretations as there are seats in the theater, as there are people in seats in the theater, which some people get – most people really like it. I mean, like – not knowing, like the ambiguity or knowing that they've got their own take on it, or like the discussion. Some people seem a little frustrated by it, but I would wonder why one would be frustrated by it. But for me, I don't know. I don't think about it much, actually. I kind of have in the back of my head what I like. But what's kind of cool is I just thought, I don't really care one way or another. And I think – I don't know. How do I know it won't change in 10 days? Or how do I know I'll look at it again and go, oh, you know what I think? Or you know what I want to feel here? You know what I choose to think? Mm-hmm. Or choose not knowing, kind of, you know. Yeah, I think the not knowing is the best option.
Well, Michael Keaton, thank you so much for this interview, and thank you for your performance in Birdman.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
Michael Keaton speaking to Terry Gross. It's one of our favorite Fresh Air interviews so far this year. Bay Area jazz vocalist Tiffany Austin spent 5.5 years singing in Japan, then returned to the States to go to law school. But once she had her diploma, she went back to singing. Her debut album features many songs by the great songwriter Hoagie Carmichael, who, by the way, also had a law degree. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Skylar, have you anything to say? To me, can you tell me where love can be? Is there a middle in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed?
Tiffany Austin on Hokey Carmichael and Johnny Mercer's Skylark from her debut Nothing But Soul. The album title comes from a song she doesn't do, the 60s Betty Carter vehicle, Jazz Ain't Nothing But Soul. Austin takes that advisory to heart. Based in Tokyo for years, she sang jazz, pop, and gospel on a variety of gigs, and she can modulate her vocal quality from sweet to dusky to raspy like there's more than one singer in there. But Austin will also fuse all those strains. She has an improviser's urge to personalize a melody, gospel fervor, and a pop singer's direct way with a lyric. Ballad Baltimore Oriole in Tiffany Austin's backbeat arrangement. She does six Hoagy Carmichael tunes on Nothing But Soul, tweaking a couple of the better known ones, because it's not like you can harm a song taking a weird approach. When you're done, it's still good as new. Austin splits arranging duties with her producer and tenor saxophonist, Bay Area bandleader Howard Wiley. He gives one evergreen an archaic two-beat bounce.
Twilight time lingers on the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, the little stars climb. Always
that's Stardust, of course. Howard Wiley's jocular arrangement teeters on the edge of being too cute, but Austin keeps it grounded. Your ear stays focused on her, and she's not kidding.
And our love was new.
Hoagy Carmichael didn't compose everything on Tiffany Austin's new album. There are a couple of standards he recorded once but aren't associated with them. One of those is by another iconic American singer, songwriter, and occasional screen actor, Mr. Johnny Cash. Glenn Pearson on piano. That is way better than Hoagy Carmichael's version of I Walk the Line, and it suggests other avenues Tiffany Austin might explore. Her debut album clocks in at a shortish 40 minutes, and even then, a couple of pieces feel a little like filler. But the best of it is a convincing calling card. She's got that flexible voice, excellent pitch and rhythm, and she can weave her own line around a melody and still let you hear the original behind it. That is more than enough to make Austin a singer to keep an ear on.
Ooh, I get along without you very well.
perhaps in spring. But I should never think of spring, for that would surely break my heart.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Nothing But Soul, the new album by singer Tiffany Austin. Next time on Fresh Air, Jonathan Franzen tells us about his new novel Purity, which, in part, is about secrets.
I'm in the business of betraying secrets about myself. I'm not going to tell you everything, but I'm going to tell you more than most people would tell the world.
Franzen's other novels include the bestsellers The Corrections and Freedom. I hope you can join us. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.